You can't farm if you don't have land. It's like trying to paint without a canvas. And yet that's the case for so many farmers across this country. The number of farms in the U.S. is decreasing, and the cost of farm real estate has nearly doubled, shutting out many prospective farmers.
That's especially true for people of color. 98% of farmland is owned by white landowners. Land access is one of the most critical issues of agriculture today. With better land access, farming would be more sustainable, achievable, and diverse. Without it, farmers can't farm. It's the top reason that young people report leaving agriculture.
But there's another harm that's hidden within the crisis of land access. It's harder to measure, but no less important. With land out of reach, fewer and fewer people have a relationship with the earth. That means fewer and fewer people get the benefits that land has to offer. Wonder, refuge, calm, abundance.
Not to mention, the land becomes more vulnerable to those who see it as a commodity, something to pave over or wring dry. To protect the earth, we must create a relationship with it.
Fortunately, there are people out there who are committed to repairing our relationship with the land, and they're sharing what they know. So on today's episode, we get back to our roots and find out what can change when we reimagine and rekindle our relationship with the land.
This is Cultivating Resilience, the show where farm care starts with self-care. I'm Hans Hageman.
And I'm Kay Megan Washington.
Should I mute my mic when I know that he's barking and if you're speaking?
That's Danielle Pelaez, or her dog, at least.
Can you? Uh-oh. Sorry.
That's okay. Danielle spoke to us from her home in upstate New York on a cold winter morning.
That kind of like sharp cold air. We just got some snow, and I feel like you could smell that in the air and the pines.
Danielle is the education coordinator at Soulfire Farm.
You may have heard of Soulfire before. It's an Afro-Indigenous centered community farm focused on uprooting racism and seeding sovereignty in the food system.
Soulfire Farm itself is located on the ancestral lands of the Stockbridge Munsee Band of the Mohican Nation, whose peoples were forcibly removed from those territories to a reservation that's in northern Wisconsin. So we are now on what is present day known as Grafton, nestled in between these beautiful mountains, and there's a small stream, and that's kind of woken up and is burbling its way along the banks.
Danielle has been on her own journey with the land.
My farming journey, like I'm realizing so many things, is very cyclical. My grandfather was a farmer, and some of my uncles were farmers in Guatemala. And I was pretty disconnected from that as a career life way until I started community gardening at two different community gardens in my neighborhood in Southwest Baltimore, and having a co-leadership role at those gardens. And I just got super hooked. I love just like the magic of the soil and building a relationship with the soil and planting seeds. And I actually had no idea. I had heard of Soulfire before, but I had no idea that Soulfire was this close. And it just happened that after we purchased our land, I found out it was just 20 minutes away.
For Danielle, a connection with the earth is built into being a farmer and a human.
I mean, also, I do think that farmers are inherently in relationship with the land just by the nature of our work, you know, like our living depends on the land.
Has this always been the way that you've related to the land, or was this something that evolved over time?
I think it's something, again, going back to that cyclical nature that has come back to me. I think, you know, as a weirdo solitary child who spent a lot of time in nature, having kind of this constant communication with the plants and with the trees, viewing the trees as my friends, you know, that felt like more of a dialogue that I lost.
And Danielle's not the only one who feels that way.
Oh, I love my young people because they love Mama Earth. So it's a circular love affair.
That's Rev Deli.
I am Rev Deli. I'm grandmother, mystic, and earth keeper. I am a minister. I'm sixth generation minister, activist minister at that. And I'm responding to a spiritual call from my Mi'kmaq ancestors to lead the resilience.
Rev doesn't have to wonder if she's connected to the earth. She knows.
I remember my first oneness experience with the Creator when I was about 9 years old. And we were in a tent. Back in those days, the tent was actually on the ground. And I would put my face on the earth, and I could hear the wind rustling in the leaves of the trees. And it just felt like my consciousness was being bathed.
The work that I'm doing now came about really through a spiritual call that I received while I was in the forest. And it was very dramatic. I was driven out of the forest with a swarm of ticks. And this big booming voice said, "Teach the church how to model sustainability." Well, honey, I was not thinking about doing that.
For most of us, the signal isn't as strong. And there are well-documented reasons for that.
We know that colonialism is what disrupted the spiritual connection with nature. And so it's not natural for Christians to believe the things that we believe and to reject things that we reject. I poke at my Christian brothers and sisters. I says, "Well, you know, when God started a garden, the first thing God did was plant a tree. So why are you guys taking the trees out?" Just a little jab. I'll be nice. But anyway.
The story of land in America is dark. There's a long and violent history of dispossession and expulsion.
There has been this intense disconnect from the land, disconnect that was done intentionally. Many of us, many of the folks who come to Soul Fire, interact with Soul Fire, we come from different peoples whose specific lineages were very forcibly disconnected from the land, whether, you know, that was through, you know, genocide of First People, transatlantic slave trade, through forced migration, from trade policies, from climate change refugees, war refugees. There's, you know, many of us come from this, carry a lot of trauma with regards to the land, and it's a process of rebuilding that relationship.
And that's hardly ancient history.
The effects of redlining are, like, these things were not that long ago and are still present day in the way that cities and, you know, municipal governments decide to distribute loans or tax exemptions. To me, what it still comes down to is these, you know, these larger structural issues in terms of, you know, climate change, land loss, things like pipeline spills that pollute land, including farmland, and like the intersecting nature of all like the isms that exist, and a lack of support, a lot of the support that's given to these conventional commodity farms, you know, growing corn and soybeans. We're not seeing that level of support for small scale farms, for diversified farms. To me, it's very understandable and makes a lot of sense that farmers are dealing with such really, really, really high levels of stress, of mental illness, of self-harm. And that's also something that you see globally too.
That disconnect is serious because the relationship with the land can be incredibly healing, both physically and mentally.
You know, thinking about how the land has been healing for me as a source of companionship and as a source of processing my life, the mental health benefits it served, as well as like the very tangible, you know, physical health benefits. There are so many studies that have come out now talking about how spending time in nature, under trees, has really positive effects on blood pressure levels, on health outcomes, stress management.
Like anything else, you start where people are and you just invite them to put their hands in the soil. And as you're working next to them, you make them aware of what's happening. They make them aware of the chemicals that they are receiving into their body as their hands are in the soil. You take them into the forest and you invite them to breathe with the tree. Okay, touch the tree. Feel what happens when you sit against the tree for X amount of time. See what happens. Even in our stuffy permaculture classes, they will tell you, go sit somewhere for 2 hours and don't move. As you sit there, your awareness will shift. You will shift into a whole nother zone. You will hear things you did not hear at the beginning. You will see things you did not see at the beginning. So nature has a way of drawing you in if
and when you allow that to happen.
What are some ways that you might suggest that other farmers who this might not be a practice or a mindset that they are as familiar with or as comfortable with, what are some ways that they might deepen their relationship to the land?
First of all, if they are not the original stewards of those lands, learning more about those original stewards beyond just, you know, looking up land on the Native Land website, then taking the additional step of making connections, of reaching out, learning how to support those peoples, learning about their history and present day struggles, and, you know, trying to educate yourself on your own history and your own role, and letting that kind of propel you forward into positive action and positive connections with your immediate community and then rippling out.
Learning about indigenous practices and her own Mi'kmaq roots expanded Rev's understanding of the earth.
We begin with the idea that all life has consciousness. If it has consciousness, we can communicate. And if it has consciousness, then what we do impacts them, what they do impacts us. I talk about and I teach how human beings are a mirror imprint of nature. And so when you are growing indigenously, you're just honoring who's there as if they matter, as if they are a family member. We talk about all our relations and we learn what lesson do they have for us.
I think that by doing that, it will kind of help put your relationship with the land that you are tending in a different lens, kind of really viewing ourselves as farmers, as stewards of the land as well.
That's a wonderful way to think about that, the difference between owning land versus being a caretaker for it for now and also taking care of it for whoever comes after you when you're gone.
But you can't have a relationship with the land if you don't have access to land.
Also, land access. Land access is huge. There are, you know, I've talked to so many young farmers who want to farm, but they just cannot afford land. And so, you know, without having access to land, we're going to lose this whole other generation of farmers to, you know, to these larger corporate farms. And all of those things impact BIPOC farmers the most. It impacts marginalized farmers the most.
But access has its limits.
I've had several pieces of land. We had a lease with someone who refused to let us come onto the land when it was planting time. And this was a farming lease. Now, I was able to go onto the property to do our educational work, but they said, no, you're going to disturb the other people with all that farming stuff. I've had land where people would spray GMO, you know, Roundup and everything on my plants. They would cut things off because they thought they were too tall. Actually, I was living on family land in Virginia, and because I was doing this quote-unquote nonsensical work, the house was sold out from under me. I came home from our Cuba delegation, and my items were in storage.
For indigenous communities, this story is far from new, but it's still happening today.
When I first moved to New York in 2019, it was all in the papers with the Ramapo Lenape tribe. They had been donated 13 acres of land in New Jersey, and their neighbors were suing them because they put up prayer flags, were suing them because they had statues on their own land. And this is 2019, okay? So I'm not talking about ancient history. I'm talking about right now, we need legal protection to do the indigenous work that we need to do.
Because of her experiences, Rev approaches land access differently. She sets her sights even further on land sovereignty.
So I've had quite a few experiences with land access. I'm not interested in land access at all. It doesn't matter what kind of leases you have. It doesn't matter about your access. You must be able to control your land. And so we formed Indigenous Mothers Community Land Trust.
The Community Land Trust model is a creative way to increase access and protect land. CLTs are nonprofits that purchase land and then lease it to residents at a much lower cost. Residents can own houses on the land, and the CLT retains ownership of the land. The decreased cost allows farmers to put down roots while the trust keeps the land sovereign and collectively held.
This is a land trust to protect indigenous people in the diaspora. And so we come from a variety of lineages. We have quite a lot in common in terms of how we manage land, but those things need to be protected.
The Indigenous Mothers Community Land Trust aims to purchase a plot about 100 miles from Soulfire Farm, and they're close to making it happen.
We've identified 102 acres in Middletown, New York. It's beautiful, gentle rolling hills. There's a wetlands in the middle. There are five different pastures. It's an old, old dairy farm, 1800s, that, you know, everything is all dilapidated, but the land is beautiful. It's gorgeous. The deer run freely. You can see the Shawangunk mountain ridge from almost any hill on the property. And so it's a beautiful place to be.
Rev's dreams of a sovereign indigenous community are one way that imagination can steer our success. And when we reimagine our relationship with the land, we can reimagine other systems too. And could you explain to us a little bit more about the circular economy that you talked about?
Circular economy means that we first of all shift from being only consumers to being producers, okay? And as we become producers, now we must create networks to fulfill each other's needs. So what's planned for this land is that this will be a place where farmers from New Jersey and farmers from New York City can come to create their own markets. Okay, so not only are we sovereign on our land, we are sovereign on with the food that we grow, but we are also sovereign with who we sell to and who do we buy from.
Soulfire pursues land access through their advocacy work, but they also provide valuable opportunities for people to create connections with the land through their programming. In fact, that's Danielle's job as education coordinator.
We have day-long volunteer days where we invite community members to come to the farm, and half-day or day-long more educational workshops. Like we had a kimchi making workshop, a mycology workshop last year, and we have week-long farming immersion programs. I think there's a lot of joy in that period. We talk about, you know, our histories of resilience and making, like, dreaming for the future.
Soulfire programming reaches thousands of people a year. And they even create relationships where land is scarce.
The Soulfire in the City program, which is very near and dear to my heart as someone who, you know, previously had always lived in city urban spaces. And that is a program where we go and we build raised beds to community members and groups in the 518 area code, not just building the beds, but we start the seedlings in our greenhouses at Soulfire. We offer seeds, soil, and it's a very educational process where we are just doing a lot of the handholding of, like, this is how you read the seed packet. This is how you plant the seeds. This is how you transplant. And then doing ongoing, you know, check-ins and partnering up with mentors.
The effects of these programs are powerful and they don't take long to emerge.
Can you give me an example of just seeing someone in one of your community programs sort of get it, connect with the land in a different way than they had been previously?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So many. But I think one woman that sticks out to me, she was a younger Black woman and who had never visited Soulfire before. And she, like, approached with such caution and was very kind of timid and made all these apologies for, you know, her shoes. She didn't know what were the right shoes. She read that she should bring boots, but she only had these, like, really cute, like, velvet boots. And she was just so, like, nervous about the whole experience. And it was just, like, a really beautiful opportunity to, like, you know, being able to be like, actually, we have, like, a whole boot lending library and layers lending library. And, there's a centering process that we do, a moment that we begin all of our programs of, you know, giving gratitude to the land, and then being able to work, you know, with my colleagues of making sure that this person felt safe and taken care of. And it was just really cool to see, like, her throughout the day just get empowered and ask a lot of questions and Then eventually by the end asked if she could take things home. She had never picked a berry before and so like had a blast picking raspberries.
Programming like this can help people establish a relationship with the land, even without access. And as Danielle found, it can be restorative to you too.
And it was just so, like, such a beautiful thing to witness over the course of the day. And it felt like such an immense honor to be able to be in that role of, you know, kind of facilitating that experience and to really see someone blossom on the land and develop confidence and laughing alongside people and building those connections with other people and with, you know, all the plants that she was interacting with. I just think about her a lot and I'm just really happy that, you know, it felt like a day that brought healing and brought empowerment to this person.
The land offers so many things: refuge, inspiration, sustenance, even freedom. All these things are both political and deeply personal. And the personal can help achieve the political. In fact, it might be necessary.
My parents continued to take us into nature. But when I became a teenager, they made it clear that they were going into nature as a refuge from the civil rights work that they were doing. They were frontline civil rights activists, and it did take its emotional toll on all of us. And so I remember in high school, my mother would say after a really bad week, "We're going to the mountains." What people also don't know is that many of our liberators in the past had special relationships with nature. George Washington Carver, Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, all of them were mystics, and they had very special relationships with nature that enabled them to do the work that they are known for. Even today, I teach that justice begins as inner balance, and then it spreads throughout our social and political and economic systems. And in that way, we have our healing embedded in our day-to-day existence, and we don't have to do this yo-yo activity that we're doing now between working real hard and then falling out with trauma.
So as we work to increase land access, we must also reimagine our relationship with the land, something Soulfire has been doing from the very beginning.
The soils of the land were so degraded when they passed into the hands of the founding family in 2006 due to the most recent history of heavy logging that was done in a really unsustainable way. And so we at Soulfire are committed to this very, what feels like a very sacred work of rebuilding the relationship to the land as a relative, which, you know, means what it sounds like of treating this land as a relative, how you would treat an elder or someone important to your family. This means asking permission. It means giving thanks, showing gratitude, paying close attention and noticing details, using regenerative practices and closely examining our own mindsets and perceptions and actions concerning the land. We very much come from this mindset of that we are the younger siblings of the land and of the beings of the land that we share the space with, the rocks, the eagles, the ponds, the trees. And then, you know, as such, we don't have the right then to treat the land like a commodity. We treat the land like we would treat our family members and with the same love and dignity and honor and respect. I do think there is a growing movement of people who are trying to pay more attention to that. And I'm also very much involved in like foraging and the foraging community. And I think that's also a conversation that's being had more often about being respectful about taking and how much you take and asking permission first. And there's a really wonderful forager, Alexis, who's Black Forager on Instagram. And she describes kind of more subtle ways of gauging whether permission is granted. For instance, if she sees a mushroom that looks appealing, but it's like surrounded by poison ivy, to her, that is a boundary that says, no, I'm not giving you permission. So just taking kind of that moment, that's something that I think everybody can and should integrate into their relationships and dynamics with nature. Again, not treating the land as a commodity that you can just like, oh, this is a pretty flower, let me take this. Or like, oh, I want to dig this up. Just taking that moment to pause, to introduce yourself, your intentions, and ask permission before taking an action. And then also that very key step of listening and paying attention and honoring the response, even if it's not a response that you would like to hear. but not losing sight of land as relative, because I do think that once you have that in your mind, it becomes more difficult. It takes more of like a cognitive dissonance to make the choice to harm the land, to exhaust the land, to, you know, extract every last drop that we can. And remembering that this land will need to sustain us, not just for this generation, and there's not, you know, this endless access, but for the next seven generations to follow, and keeping that at the forefront of thinking about families and descendants and how really wanting to leave a better world for them. And that is not possible with the relationship that most people have with the land as it is right now.
Both Danielle and Rev are generous with the land. They want to share it. It becomes a place of community. And so maybe a relationship with the land can be a template to help us heal our relationships with each other.
What role do non-Indigenous or non-Black and Brown people, what role is there for them in this kind of a movement?
Well, of course, as allies, that means that you're supportive. If you have money, give it. You know, if you have political power, share it. Also, in terms of healing yourself from the attitudes and from the presumptions and beliefs that you have. So I think that's the role, is to agree that maybe there is another way, and maybe I can support a way that actually sustains everyone. And so it's being willing to shed maybe a little bit of privilege or to share some power. But yes, there's a role, because we all want to thrive together. This is not really a separatist movement. This is a movement to include Black and Brown people, because right now we're, you know, sometimes invisible and very much on the bottom. It's just to allow people to have their own sovereignty over things that impact their lives, and not being afraid. Maybe that's the first step, is in people who are not Black and Brown, is to realize that you do not have to be afraid of us. We want you to be part of the human community. We want you to be productive and kind and cooperative with all of the rest of us. So just allowing your own heart to open and let that happen. Welcome. We welcome you.
And it's not just about righting past wrongs. It's creating collective futures and joyful presence.
We also, I mean, on that theme of joy, one of my favorite events is our annual solstice event, which is basically just this like festival. It's a very joyful celebration of our community, of the farm, with live music and performances and food and, you know, trying to really center the joy in this work. I also personally really love farming, like alongside other people, you know, my coworkers and colleagues and volunteers. So there's also that like really beautiful social component where we can be talking about the farming that we're doing and like problem solving, or, you know, singing along to Queen or whoever, or just working together in silence, but in like a comfortable partnership silence. Hearing the chickadees and the woodpeckers are starting to wake up. The bumblebees, you know, pollinating the marigolds next to me. The goats are making their goat sounds, and the farm dogs are chasing each other and barking. So you see them out of the corner of your eye coming up to greet you. And yeah, if you're lucky, you can hear the giggling of some of the youngest residents on the land, who are toddlers and infants.
Fun is sustainable. Mother Earth requires joyful encounter. We've put a lot of just unsensible barriers in our own way to being resilient. Being resilient is actually easy. That's the way we were designed. That's the way the Earth was designed. And so all we have to do is remove the roadblocks. These are cultural, emotional roadblocks, and nature is right there. I think the pandemic proved to us that once we gain our senses, nature responds immediately. Do you remember within, you know, 60 days that smog had moved away from mountains? People had not seen mountains in generations. So it will not take 10 generations for these changes to happen. I have changed soil in 4 years. So it's well within a lifetime that you can change your environment to support you.
I like what you said about, you know, asking if this was a reciprocal relationship, because that is always the goal, you know, and I think that's the reason why it's not just asking permission. It's also giving gratitude of holding up our end of the deal, because it, you know, we do really view it as a partnership, as a relationship that we are part of nature, and therefore nature also wants, the land also wants us back. The land also rejoices when we spend time on the land, when we practice mindfulness and spend time with the soil and the forest. And I do think that, you know, I'm very anti the nihilistic position that like humans are the virus or, you know, all of that. I feel very much that, you know, we have, as being part of nature, like we do have a role to play and our responsibility. And yeah, it's just such an important calling to hold up our end of the bargain and to, yeah, to rebuild that relationship in a way that is mutually healing and mutually loving.
This episode has focused on how to reimagine your relationship with the land. This isn't a solution to the inequities of land, but it can help us get there by sustaining us and healing us. Even more, it can help us imagine a more equitable way of living, one where land isn't commodified and access isn't restricted.
Imagination is a key part of a better future. Activists like Angela Davis and Mariam Kaba describe imagination as a fundamental tool of their work, but it's not the only tool. And so, to end the episode, we wanted to share this thought from Danielle.
I think we can be in right relationship with the land and still be experiencing a lot of the benefits that come from working with the land. But I think, you know, until there is more solidarity and collaboration amongst other farmers to organize for our rights and, you know, push through change and support each other and mutual aid, that to me is towards the direction of a solution, as opposed to me saying like, oh, you just need to like go meditate under your tree every day and like think about the land as a relative, because, you know, you can, you and you should, but then it feels like it stops there. And I think that's something at Soulfire, one arm of what we do is policy work, is advocacy, is rabble rousing, because we realize that like, sure, we can train and equip the next generation of BIPOC farmers, but like, then what? You know, we're sending them off into this world where there is no support, a broken healthcare system, no labor protections, like all these things that don't support mental health. And so that's also like a responsibility that we have as well of like, you know, collaborating with other farms and farming advocacy groups.
There are plenty of issues that can't be repaired from inside our heads. The imagination must be paired with action, advocacy, organizing, mutual aid.
And so on the next episode of Cultivating Resilience, strategies to change the world.
Thank you to Danielle Palayas of Soulfire Farm and Rev Deli for sharing their time and stories with us.
And before we go, the Indigenous Mothers Community Land Trust is currently raising money to complete their purchase of the land in Middletown, New York.
If anyone resonates with that mission, I would just invite them to be in touch with us. Indigenous Mothers Community Land Trust, look us up online. We have a YouTube channel where we show the property and speak about the work that will be done there. You can email me at rev@revdeli.com. R-E-V is in Victory, D is in David, E-L-E.com. You can call me. I actually take phone calls, 804-389-5150. I'd be happy to talk to you.
Cultivating Resilience is a podcast from Cultivemos. Your hosts are me, Hans Hageman, and K. Megan Washington. Writing and production for this show is by Andrew Ganim, with sound mixing and editing by Alex Bennett at Lower Street Media. Until next time, stay grounded.
Our African ancestors created dances whereby your body parts were, I don't have a very good explanation without showing you, didn't come prepared to teach a dance class.
That'll be next season.